and welcome. You are about to participate in an exciting verse-by-verse Bible study. This program offers an exegetical, historical, grammatical approach to the Bible. Our host, pastor-teacher Bob Utley, tries to corroborate his teachings from five areas: word studies from the original languages, grammatical construction, context, parallel passages, or historical and cultural insights. This is one of the several series that Bob teaches weekly. Get your Bible, and let's begin our prayerful study of today's lesson.
Hello. We're going to continue our study in the book of Revelation today in chapter 13. If you're familiar with the book of Daniel, you'll know how influential Daniel chapter 7 is to the descriptions found not only in 12 that describes the evil one, but in 13 we describe two of his henchmen. Now, they have been variously described as the satanic trinity, and I think there's some truth in that, as we see Satan trying to parrot God, the beast from the sea trying to parrot Jesus, because he's going to take the description of Jesus in 5:6, and the beast from the land, something like the Holy Spirit that tries to promote Jesus. Now, what we have here is a description in composite form of the four beasts of Daniel chapter 7 that, of course, correspond to the image of Daniel chapter 2, but they're combined into one to show its fearsomeness. We're obviously in symbolic language. I hope you're not expecting to see a leopard with bare feet and a lion's mouth, because you're going to be out of luck. But it is a way of I think, describing the series of anti-God world empires. I think in John's day it was epitomized in Rome. In Daniel's prophecy, it's epitomized in the Seleucid ruler Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes. I think in the end time, it's going to be epitomized by the one world government of the end time Antichrist. And so I do think there is some validity in seeing this first beast as a human society organized and functioning apart from God, and the second beast as false religion. Now, just to give you a kind of a hint, some commentators think that 666 may refer to Nimrod. And if that's true, who's the founder of Babylon, then we see why in chapter 17 we see Babylon as a great whore, which is typified of this anti-God world government. Now, let's go to the chapter if we could then. By the way, I want to mention to you that, as in all these chapters, the people who believe that this is to be fulfilled historically try to find examples in the Roman Empire. Those who believe it's going to be fulfilled historically, but at the end time, project all this out into the future. If you're looking for a good book that deals with the setting of first century Rome, this is the book of the Revelation in the Anchor Bible series. It's a very technical book, but it really deals extensively with some of the history that may be behind this chapter. Personally, I believe it is apocalyptic literature, was never meant to be taken detailed historically. Although some aspects may fit into that, that's not the ultimate purpose. But to see this anti-God world system developing. Okay, now, let's look then if we could. But I stood on the sand of the seashore. Now, this "I stood" is very unfortunate. It comes from an inferior manuscript. It really is the last phrase of chapter 12. The better manuscripts have "he stood," meaning the dragon stood on the seashore to kind of rally his twin henchmen coming out, one of the sea and one of the land. Now, so I think it should be "he," and the manuscripts are so much better for "he." On the seashore, and I saw a wild beast. Now, this wild beast is going to be a composite, like I said, of Daniel chapter 7. I think this is the end-time Antichrist mentioned in 1 John chapter 2, verse 18, called the man of lawlessness by Paul in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 3. And I think depicted earlier in the book of Revelation, chapter 11, verse 7, simply they are called the beast. Now, coming up out of the sea, I think there are several possible backgrounds to that. Jewish apocalyptic literature and the rabbis have said that this refers to Leviathan and Behemoth. And there's a lot of writing in this intertestamental period using those two ancient large animals, monsters. We've looked earlier how Rahab and Leviathan may have been the background of some of the other allusions, and that's quite possible. But I think here, Daniel chapter 7, verse 3, a beast comes out of the land, out of the sea, and verse 17 of Daniel chapter 7, a beast comes out of the land. And that, excuse me, that seems to be the background here. Now, there is a possibility that there is another background, and that would be Isaiah 17, 12 and 13, Isaiah 57, 20. Now, this same kind of thing is going to be discussed in Revelation 17, 15 in the very same terms. Notice, it had 10 horns and 10 heads and 10 diadems on the horns. Very similar to the beast of chapter 12, but a little bit different to show they're not exactly the same. Now, the 10 horns is a sign of power, and obviously goes back to Daniel 7. And the 7 heads might be just the place the 10 diadems fit on. So it's obviously a very satanic beast with great power. Notice it had blasphemous titles. This is Daniel 7:25. Many of these blasphemous things are mentioned here. We see this blasphemy in Daniel 7, 8, 11, 20, and 25. How the little horn boasts great things. Now, these blasphemous titles, there is some manuscripts division here on whether it's plural or singular. And so I'm not 100% sure. It's either different names on every one of the diadems or one name. It's obviously allusions to this personage claiming deity. You might want to see that same thing is going to happen in chapter 17. Now, notice it mentions, the wild beast which I saw was like a leopard with bear's feet and a lion's mouth. Isn't it funny it's going to have 7 heads but 1 lion's mouth? Obviously, this is apocalyptic language. This combines the first 3 of the 4 images of Daniel chapter 7 into a composite figure. So you see that John is changing the Old Testament and not simply, he's drawing imagery from it, but he's changing it. And I think that's significant. Now, in Daniel 7:24, these diadems and horns related to different kings. Here, I'm not sure we can do that. A lot of folks make a big deal out of 10 successive kings and try to find 10 Roman emperors or the common market or some end-time 10. But I think we're pushing too hard, really, in that area. Notice, to him the dragon gave his own power and throne with great authority. Now, this is the idea of how satanically inspired this Antichrist is going to be. He's the incarnation of Satan. You might want to see 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 9. About the power, the satanic power this individual is going to have. And I saw one of his heads seemed to have been mortally wounded, but the mortal wound had been healed. This is a perfect passive participle. In English, it kind of seems like it looked like he was dead, but he really wasn't. No, this is the idea that he is dead and comes back to life. It's exactly the same grammatical phrase as used of the lamb that was slain but alive back in chapter 5, verse 6. This is one of the first examples of how this evil person is going to parody or mimic the Messiah. And this is the first example of that. Some see, especially those who want to put this in the first century Rome, try to see this as the Nero coming back to life myth. And I certainly see that as something that was current in John's day, but I don't think John would use it in his book, to tell you the truth. I think the background to much of this chapter is emperor worship, particularly in the eastern provinces known as the Concilia. Remember, I think the second beast is going to be the Concilia of the eastern provinces. This emperor worship was really resisted by most of the early Caesars. The first one to really get hung up on it was Caligula. Nero was kind of caught up in it, but nothing like Domitian is going to be. And so I think that probably is the background in John's mind, but I think it's going to be focused personally into a future end-time Antichrist. Now, notice where it says it had been healed. As the first one is a perfect passive participle, this is aorist passive indicative. He has been brought back to life. And the whole world was amazed. Now, the word amazed here means amazed in the sense of admire. Now, this idea about signs and wonders and amazing the whole world is going to be used particularly in the second beast of how he's going to do wonders and wow men. There's something of the parody here of the two witnesses back in chapter 11, verse 6. You might want to see Revelation 11:13 and Revelation 17:8 as a parallels to this. Notice in verse 4 it says, worship the dragon. Now the dragon is Satan, see chapter 12, verse 9. And also worship the wild beast. This is not primarily political power. There is a spiritual element here. The dragon wants worship. If you go back to the temptation experience of Jesus, that's what Satan wanted from Jesus. The devil is out to take God's place. That seems to be the whole thing of the fall, if you can see Satan behind the king of Babylon, the king of Tyre, in Isaiah 14 and Ezekiel 28. And I think you can. Notice it down here, it says, who is like the wild beast? And there are two possibilities. If you see Leviathan as the background to the dragon, this may be an allusion to Job 41, 33 and 34, where it says, who is like Leviathan? But if you see it as a parody of God again, and the phrase in the Old Testament, who is like Yahweh? Then you go back to Exodus 15:11, Psalms 35:10, and you can see the background to this concept of the parody of evil of good. Now in verse 5, but there was given to the wild beast a mouth. Now this whole concept of was given is very significant here. In verses 5 through 7, it's said seven times. It appears again in verses 14 and 15. Now, was permission given by the devil to the beast? Yes, that is the immediate context. But behind the immediate context is the idea that God the Father allowed the devil to have this power and to give it to the beast. So there's something here of God in control of all history, even evil. Now, this blasphemous words, exactly what is that? Well, I'm not sure. It's obviously Daniel 7, 8, 11, 20, and 25. Some see it in 1 Thessalonians 2, 4, where he claims to be God, and that's the idea of blasphemy having religious connotations. And permission to wield his authority 42 months. That goes back to Daniel 7, 25. I've listed that for you in numerous programs about how often this 42-month period is mentioned. Times and a half times. Obviously, a half of seven. It seems to me to be a symbolic number for the period of persecution. Now, in Daniel, it speaks of the period of Antiochus Epiphanes. I think in Jesus' words in Matthew 24, Mark 13, Luke 21, it spoke of the period where the army of Rome under Titus would destroy Jerusalem. I think, obviously, in this period, it was something of the reign of Domitian in John's day. I think in the future, it's going to be the period of aggressive tribulation and persecution that precedes the second coming. Many people in here see Jesus' words in Matthew 24 about the abomination of desolation, which seemed to apply to Titus in Matthew 24, now applied to the Antichrist. Now, notice where it says, and he opened his mouth to blaspheme against God, his name and his dwelling place. There is some doubt there in the Greek text about the number of chi's or ands in there. We're not sure if it's three different groups or just one group connected, but obviously this person is against God and all that God stands for is and all of God's people. Verse 7, permission was given him, and there's that idea that God's in control again, even if the evil one is the one giving the beast this permission, to make war on God's people. Oh, my. Well, that goes back directly to Daniel chapter 7, verses 21 and 25 again. You say, why? Well, we don't know. We're never told. There is more going on in the spiritual realm than we understand. But friends, we know the nature of God. We know the heart of God. We know the love of God. Though we don't understand, we can trust Him in the midst of it. It won't be permanent. They can't take away our salvation. But the saints, though protected with a seal, are going to have to die and be hurt. God help us. And to conquer them. Authority was given him, there it is again, over every tribe, people, language, and nation. Now, in my opinion, this is why this is much wider than just first century Rome. Rome wasn't the whole known world of that day, and this seems to be a worldwide kind of thing. So I am a futurist. I believe this is end time. Now, in verse 8, and the inhabitants of the earth, whose name from the foundation of the world has not been written in the slaughtered lamb's book of life, will worship him. Notice that only those who are unbelievers will be tricked by all this. Now, let me just go through this a little bit at a time. The inhabitants of the earth is that phrase used so often in the book of Revelation to always refer to the unredeemed. Notice where it says, has not been written in the slaughtered lamb book of life. Now, grammatically, And the different translations do it different. This word, before the foundation of the world, what happened before the foundation? Were our names written in the Lamb's Book of Life, or was the Lamb slaughtered? Well, now, the Revised Standard Version says that our names were written in the Lamb's Book of Life before the foundation is the key, and they go to Revelation 17:8 for a parallel. Now, the Authorized Version says, no, it was Jesus that was slain before the foundation of the earth. And they go to 1 Peter chapter 1, verses 19 and 20 for a backup. Now, I think really it probably refers to Jesus being slain, because that's the whole key. But the idea of our names in the Lamb's Book of Life is in chapter 17:8. Now, this little phrase, before the foundation of the earth, is very interesting. It's used several different times in the Bible to show us some things that happen even before creation. Matthew 25:34, John 17:24. 1 Peter 1, 19 and 20, and Ephesians 1, 4. A phrase very much like it is used to describe other events that happened from the very beginning. Matthew 13, 35, Luke 11, 50, Hebrews 4, 3, Hebrews 9, 26, Revelation 17, 8. You might want to look those up. There's a great blessing in knowing what God has already done for us. And this little catchphrase, I think those who knew their Bibles would pick up on that and realize all that God has done for them. Now, the deal about a slaughtered lamb. We found that so often, first back in chapter 7, verse 14, then in chapter 12, verse 11. It's the blood, it's the sacrificial death that is so significant. That phrase about Jesus' death and his cross and his blood and his sacrifice is used over and over and over and over, that concept, in the book of the Revelation. It's the key theme of how the saints have overcome. Now, the book of life goes back to Daniel 7, chapter 10. I also think in Revelation chapters 20, verses 11 through 15, particularly verse 12, we see there are two books of life. Now, these two books of life, I think we need to recognize how they're used. I have a list of them back here I want to turn to. Now, the book of life, of course, is the book of the redeemed. We see that in Exodus 32:32, Psalm 69:28, Daniel 12:1. We see it in Isaiah 4:3, Luke 10:20. Philippians 4:3, Hebrews 17:23, Revelation 13:8, 17:8, 20:15, and 21:27. Now, the other book is known as the Book of Deeds, the Book of Remembrances. Psalms 56:8, Psalms 139:16, Isaiah 65:6, and Malachi 3:16. These two books are going to be the basis upon which men are judged. Now, notice where it says in the next verse, if anyone has an ear, let him hear. It's a very important phrase. We see it in chapter 2, verse 7, verse 17, 3, 6, 3, 13, 3, 22. It's repeated in the letter of the seven churches. Why? He's saying, now look, think clearly what I'm saying. There's been much discussion about exactly what verse 10 is all about. Some translate it very, very different. The Williams translation that I use follows the King James and says that both phrases refer to the persecutors. And I think there's some real truth in that. Others have said, no, the first, or this Revised Standard Version, says the first refers to the persecuted and the last refers to the persecutors. This has been used to say that Christians shouldn't resist evil in the world. This is not certain what it is. I think it's referring to the persecutors. But I can't be 100% sure. There's a series of ifs through here. All of them are first class, assumed to be true. Now, notice where it says, whoever kills with a sword, that seems to be an allusion to the words of Jesus in Matthew 26:52. Now, it closes with this. In this way will be shown the patient endurance and fidelity of God's people. Oh, this reminds me of back in chapter 12, verses 11 and 17, and particularly in chapter 14, verse 12, where it kind of defines what God's children are. Well, they're one who have been redeemed by the blood of the Lamb and have accepted the testimony about Jesus. Not only that, but they've obeyed the command. So I think these three verses really are an emphasis on believers. And, of course, for me, I think it's the New Testament people of God that we would call the church. Now, in verse 11, we have the second beast comes out. Some see the first beast is the world government of Rome. I think that goes back to Babylon, going to be used in chapter 17, and the image of the image of the coming kingdoms in Daniel 2. Now, they would say that's imperial Rome and this is religious Rome. There's some truth in that, for I think this probably does represent the concilia in John's day, that arm in the eastern provinces that pushed emperor worship and enforced it if someone wouldn't do it. I think in the end time is going to come something quite like this. And I do see personally a satanic trinity here because there's so much parity between what God's trying to do and what the devil's trying to do. Now, then I saw another wild beast coming up out of the land. That goes back to Daniel 7:17. Now, some say these two beasts are to mimic the two witnesses of chapter 11. Now, there may be some truth in that because he's going to call down fire from heaven, which sounds just like what Elijah did back in 1 Kings 18:36. And what the two witnesses are described like back in chapter 11, verse 6. So that may be the background. Now, here it goes. He had two horns like a lamb, obviously another parody of Christ, okay? He spoke like a dragon. There's his true nature. And he makes the earth and its inhabitants worship the first wild beast whose mortal wound had been healed. Sounds kind of like a parody of the Holy Spirit who points men to Christ. The second beast will point men to the first beast. Now, notice where it mentions, he exercised the full authority of the first wild beast in his presence. He's not a competitor, no. He is someone who's going to facilitate. And he makes the earth and the inhabitants worship the wild beast whose mortal wound has been healed. Verse 13. He performs great wonders, present tense, over and over. Now, these great wonders are going to cause the world to believe in him. Some have said this is another example of how the two witnesses back in chapter 11, the whole world was awed by their wonders. But now this wild beast is going to do signs and wonders and lead these fickle people to the worship of the beast. Well, I think it's a good example of something we need to hear in our day when we're so concerned about miracles. In Matthew 24:24, it says in the end time are going to come those who can do signs and wonders. You might want to see Mark 13:22. You might want to see 2 Thessalonians 2:9-12. And in the Didache, chapter 16, verses 3 and 4, talks about that at the end time is going to be not only an intensification of evil, but an intensification of miracles done by these false prophets. Matter of fact, this wild beast from here on out is called the false prophet in the rest of the book of the Revelation, 16:13, 19:20, and 20 verse 10. He calls down fire from heaven. He leads the inhabitants of the earth astray because of the wonders he is permitted to perform. Now, he's going to get a statue that looks like the beast. He's going to impart life to it, and the statue is going to say that everybody who doesn't worship me be killed. Now, is this a real miracle of giving life to something? Well, I think only God has that power. So it's either a trickery, it's a ventriloquism, or there is some real power in evil. Now, I think both are true. I don't think evil is as powerful as God, but I think Satan does have tremendous power. And so, now, to bring something to life, I think it's a trick. I don't think Satan has that power. Notice that the saints are going to be killed if they don't have this mark of the beast mentioned in verse 16. Now, this word mark means an animal brand. Now, back in this first century, we know that slaves were branded, and sometimes soldiers took on a tattoo of their general. But some say because it's on the forehead, it's maybe a way to mimic the Jewish use of phylacteries. I'm not sure. Now, some say it's just the number of this beast. Now, this is very interesting. Notice down in verse 18, we get into this number of this beast. It says, for its number of a certain man. Now, I think we've been a little taken off when we say a certain man, we're looking for a proper name. Seems to me the text means the kind of man this is. Now, if you take this, they call it gematria, this number trickery, and the closest we can come is Caesar Nero written in Hebrew with a variant spelling. Now, it gets pretty tough. I think that's really kind of fanciful. I really think if you add up the numbers for Jesus, you get 888, which is one better than perfection. If you add up the number of men, it's the idea of 666, which is powerful, but one less than perfection. And so I think it kind of shows it's a number for the world governments. They look powerful, they look strong, but they really fall short. And I think that's what it is, more than just trying to figure out who this is. Now, some manuscripts have 616, but I'm going to tell you the better ones, P47, Aleph, A, and P all have 666, and I think that's true. Now, there have been some say that Caligula fits this. The first one really talked about this was Irenaeus, And he thought it meant a Latin term for the Roman Empire. Now, that may be very true. He also said that he knew about some manuscripts that had 616, but he said those who knew John face to face had 666. And so he kind of brings some help on that. I think sometimes if you ever get many of these big commentaries that show you all the interpretations through history, it'll amaze you at how they've tried to put this on different individuals through time. It seems to me we're always trying to force the book of the Revelation into our historical circumstances, our cultural setting. And we get the wildest interpretations. I don't think God's trying to hide truth from us, but this book is written in a way to describe, I think, end time events in light of first century events. So one reason we don't fully able to explain or interpret this is because we don't have the proper setting yet. Now, we can see it in Rome somewhat, but I think when the last generation finally arrives, that some of this very symbolic language will begin to make more sense to those Christians. Because throughout this chapter, it kept saying that the beast and his henchmen are going to trick everybody in the world except the believers. Matter of fact, in Matthew 24, it talked about these signs and wonders would lead people, even the elect, astray if possible. But God's people are going to...